good to be back with you this morning. As Brother Hensley said, we've been studying the book of Jeremiah. We went through some things that had to do with the judgments that were pronounced against it. We talked about the introduction last night. We talked about the theme of the book that involves false teachers and spent quite a bit of time talking about that. This morning for class, I want to talk about some of the symbolism that we see in the book and very descriptive language that is used, and language that is somewhat interesting to me. I told someone of the lessons that I put together on this book. This, to me personally, is the most interesting of the studies. You start out very quickly in the book of Jeremiah with some symbology, with some symbolism that is there, figurative language that is used to represent some thing, some concept, some occurrence. For example, in chapter 1, very quickly we see in verses 11 and 12, Jeremiah records these words, "The word of the Lord came to me, saying, What do you see, Jeremiah? And I said, I see a rod of an almond tree. Then the Lord said to me, You have seen well, for I am watching over my word to perform it." What was he talking about there? Why did God tell him that this means that I'm watching over my word to perform it? Well, because he said it was the rod of an almond tree. The almond tree is from a Hebrew word that means hasty. In other words, the almond tree was the first one to bud. It was called the early tree. And so it's significant that this would be used, this particular tree of all trees, because it indicated that something was going to happen very soon. That's the key to that. In verses 11 and 12 of Jeremiah chapter 1, God is indicating His readiness to punish. Something is going to happen very soon. And then right after that, in Jeremiah chapter 1, verses 13 and 14, you see another one of these. "The word of the Lord came to me a second time, saying, What do you see? And I said, I see a boiling pot facing away from the north. And the Lord said to me, Out of the north the evil will break forth on all the inhabitants of the land." I see a boiling pot, a cauldron, a cooking pot. And the idea, if you think of boiling water and spilling that out, of course, generally when we get burned, we think of intense pain. We think of something that hurts. We think of something that we regret. Now, when that happens, you say, "I wish I could take that time back." It's kind of like my finger right now, where last week I had was cutting some trim, or a couple of weeks ago, and I had a warped board. And so, well, when this wasn't trim, this was a little bit of framing. I remember now it was a warped tube before, and I thought, I need to hold that in such a way to keep that saw blade from jerking that. And so I thought I'd hold it away from the rip fence a little bit so that I didn't put it in too much of a bind. And when I did that, it jammed that finger in between that tube before and that rip fence real hard. And it was just about the worst I've ever smashed my finger. That's one of those times where you have to go get the drill bit out, by the way, and take care of that little problem. But it hit me, why did I do that? And I thought, if only, I'm real busy, I had a lot of typing to do, and that just didn't work out too well. And I thought, if only I could just roll the clock back just a little bit and just take that back from that pain. Well, God is saying pain is coming. And the boiling pot, I think, signifies that very expressly. We think of the idea of pain and pouring out of the contents of a hot cauldron on the inhabitants of the land. And this is exactly what verses 15 and following say was going to happen. So the boiling pot signifies the coming of the Babylonian army. It would come from the north. And I got off on this a little bit the other night, so I'm going to skip through some things here. Let me just mention a couple of verses for those who weren't here, weren't able to be here the other night when we talked about this. Disaster from the north is simply emphasizing the direction. Some look to this and say, well, this has to be a contradiction. Why would the Babylonians over to the east come from the north? Well, because of the easier travel route and their approach. It was a logistical thing, is what it was. And so the enemies would approach from the north. Of course, the Scythians did too. The others were known for that as well and for that practice. But several times in the book of Jeremiah, we see this happen. I want to take a look over at chapter 2. Chapter 2 in verse 13, where we see the verse, "For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, to hew for themselves cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water." What is the significance of the broken cistern? What does Jeremiah mean by that? What is he talking about? Well, it says basically there were two evils. First of all, the people had forsaken God, who is identified here as being the fountain of living water. The fountain of living water. In other words, a life source. He's speaking spiritually here. He's speaking of His spiritual provisions and blessings that He provided for the people to maintain them, to maintain their well-being in the promised land. But the people, as we've noted quite a bit already in this series, had violated the laws of God and had turned to pagan idolatry. And so God would punish them, as we just noted. They had forsaken God. Over in John chapter 4 and verse 14, Jesus identifies His ability to provide a life-sustaining water, a water that if you drink of it, you will never thirst again. And this is the idea. But they forsook that and they hewed for themselves cisterns. Now, what does that mean? The cistern was not like the spring that actually produced water. But the cistern was simply a dug well, a dug hole. It didn't produce anything, but water could be put into it and it would stand there. They would actually plaster the inside of these so that it would seal them off and make water stand in them. The problem with this particular cistern, which represented false religion of the people in that day, was that it was broken. The plaster was broken, there were holes in the bottom of the cistern, and the water simply was put in and ran out as quickly as it was put in. And this represents what happens when people leave God. This is the broken cistern story. People leave God and turn to their own devices. As we talked about the false prophets last night, for example, preaching, he said, from their own imaginations. Saying things, making things up, and doing what they wanted to do. Over in Jeremiah 13, another interesting symbol, that of the linen belt or linen girdle or linen loincloth. And the story is told from verses 1 through 11 in the chapter. I don't have time to read all of that. Let me make some comments about it. In this story, this illustration, Jeremiah was told by God to go and purchase this linen girdle, this linen belt. Now, when he bought it, he was to put it on, he was to wear it. There's some discussion and disagreement over whether or not this was the inner garment that touched the body. I lean that direction. Some believe it may have been just the sash, just the belt, the outer part that fastened the garment. But I lean the other way because of the context here. But that's really irrelevant. The linen does signify the idea of holiness. It does suggest that because that was the material for the priestly garments. And the idea is he was not to put it in water. The idea is he was not to wash it. Now some say, well, it was not to be dyed because those materials were sometimes dyed and it was not to be dyed. I'd lean away from that and lean towards the idea of simply washing. And it seems to fit the context that he's describing here, a garment that was soiled as a result of use. And it became corrupt, this representing Judah's building, growing corruption. But the interesting thing about this is that Jeremiah was told by God to take this linen belt and go to Pirath, this is a place on the Euphrates, and hide it in a crevice, that's verses 4 and 5. And that's what he did, and then after some time, the record says after many days, Jeremiah was told to go and retrieve the belt. But when he got the belt, interestingly, he found it, and this is an interesting phrase because it contains so much significance, biblically, historically, he found it ruined and worthless. In other words, it had rotted here in this place that he had put it. Some believe that maybe the backwater of the Euphrates had washed back up into this crevice place and had washed soil over the top of it, and it just began to decay. But the point is, it's decay. It was ruined, and it was worthless. Now, this is just like over in Leviticus 26, which I've referenced several times. Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, the two chapters of the writings of Moses that record the warnings about what would happen if the people turned from the will of God and they started to practice sin in the land that God had given them. Notice the language of that verse. Look in your Bible or have it on the chart. Those of you who are left will waste away in the lands of their enemies because of their sins. Also because of their father's sins, they will waste away. What did we say about Manasseh? Manasseh is mentioned in the book of Jeremiah as being a part of the problem that led the people to where they were. And Bob Hensley made a very good point to me, or reminder. In the Chronicles account, if I remember, for some reason I have difficulty with that, I believe it's the Chronicles, not the Kings account of Manasseh, we read about the change, the repentance of Manasseh towards the end. Now, this is significant. Think about what happened here. You have the repentance of Manasseh and some restoration that started to take place, or reformation that started to take place. But what did Jeremiah in chapter 15 say about Manasseh? He said it was because of the sins of Manasseh. The people had already been affected by the sin, by the error, by the false practices. Josiah was king when Jeremiah began to prophesy, as we noted in our introduction, 13th year of Josiah. Josiah had destroyed Baal worship from Jerusalem. Remember the account of the Kings and Chronicles. However, what were the people doing already by the time that marks the beginning of the Babylonian invasion? And probably prior to that, they were already engaged in Baal worship and practicing that. So this is what happened. And the people are represented by the corrupted belt that now had rotted. It had decayed. In that same chapter, Jeremiah 13, verses 12 through 27, we have the story of the wineskins. Jerusalem was told, the people of Jerusalem were told, that they were to fill every wineskin full. Every wineskin is to be filled with wine. Filled with wine. The people, of course, not thinking of any spiritual significance here. Not thinking of the figurative use of this warning, of this admonition. They thought in terms of the physical, and they replied to Jeremiah, "Don't we already know this? You know, you think we're a bunch of dummies that we're going to leave space in these wineskins, and here we know there's going to be some expansion and fermentation and all of that? Don't we already know this?" Well, they obviously were not thinking, were they? We're not thinking about this possible spiritual application. Isaiah 51, verse 17, gives us a great commentary on this. Certain parts of Jeremiah 25 as well. But I cite Isaiah 51, 17 because this seems to me to be quite a commentary on what he means here by the wineskins. "Wake yourself, wake yourself. Stand up, O Jerusalem, you who have drunk from the hand of the Lord the cup of His wrath, who have drunk to the dregs the bowl, the cup of staggering." The point of all of this is that the people would be drinking of God's destruction against them, His judgment against them, and they would become as a drunken person. And they would be staggering. They would be staggering in pain. They would be staggering because of what they were witnessing, because of what had happened to them and happened to their neighbors. And so here is the idea of the wineskin. Every wineskin should be full with wine. Judgment will be complete. It will cause people to walk by and see the city of Jerusalem and the land of Judah, and there will be the hissing and all of the undertone comments about how has this come to this? How has judgment been so great? Jeremiah 16, very interesting. Jeremiah 16, verses 1 through 4. Jeremiah was told not to marry. You know, Isaiah and Hosea were prophets that not only married, but their children were significant. And you have quite a contrast here with Jeremiah. The circumstance was a little different. Jeremiah was told not to marry. I have the passage up on the overhead. "The word of the Lord also came to me, saying, you shall not take a wife for yourself, nor have sons or daughters in this place." Now this is real. Jeremiah was not to marry. "For thus says the Lord concerning the sons and daughters born in this place, and concerning their mothers who bear them, and their fathers who beget them in this land, they will die of deadly diseases. They will not be lamented or buried. They will be as dung upon the surface of the ground, and come to an end by sword and famine, and their carcasses will become food for the birds of the sky and for the beasts of the earth." Passage I somewhat referenced last night, in last night's lesson. This is what's going to happen to the people of Judah. Life will not continue in the normal. But what's going to happen is judgment is going to come, and it's not going to do you any good to have a wife. It's not going to serve any purpose for you to have children, because what's going to happen is if you have children, you're going to have to go through the hardship of seeing them slaughtered or seeing them carried off into 70 years of captivity. So God told Jeremiah not to marry, and the prohibition suggested that simply there was no positive future. By the way, tonight, last lesson, restoration, we'll change course a little bit, and we'll see the hope of restoration and messianic significances in the book of Jeremiah as well. But for now, there's no positive future for this people. Jeremiah, it'll do you no good to get married. Jeremiah was not to attend funerals. What is the significance of that? Chapter 16 as well, verses 5 through 7. For thus says the Lord, do not enter a house of mourning, or go to lament or console them, for I have withdrawn my peace from this people, declares the Lord. Remember what we said last night about the false prophets? They always went around saying, peace, peace. Jeremiah added, though, there is no peace. I have withdrawn my peace from this people, declares the Lord. My loving kindness and compassion, both great men and small, will die in this land. They will not be buried. I repeat this. They will not be lamented, nor will anyone gash himself or shave his head for them. Remember Elijah and the taunting of the false prophets of Baal? Men will not break bread in mourning for them to comfort anyone for the dead, nor give them a cup of consolation to drink for anyone's father or mother. What God wants Jeremiah to do is not attend these funerals as a sign. As a sign to show that there will be people who are going to die, people by the tens of thousands, who are going to die and will not be buried. They'll be put out into the valley of Ben Hinnom, what's called Tophet. They'll be put out there and they will simply rot. Their corpses will rot on the ground. One king was to receive the burial, and I'll not use the King James on this, the burial of a donkey. The burial of a donkey. Now you think about that. What do you do with a donkey? Well, you just slide the donkey off out into the woods or out into the field somewhere, and it rots. Now, you know, today I know with my dairy farming history, and my brothers and my dad are still in that business, you know, they mandated after some time that you have to bury those dead animals. You can't just let them lay on top of the ground. You're supposed to bury those, so, you know, now you have to hire a backhoe to come in there and dig you a big hole to put the cows in, dead cows in. But that wouldn't happen, you know. We didn't have any OSHA or EPA requirements back there in Jeremiah's day. God said, no, they'll just all be stacked up and rot out on the ground, and the birds will come and pluck the flesh from their carcasses. Very, very graphic language used in the Bible to describe God's punishment of these people. God had withdrawn His compassion from these people. God would relent no more, as we noted in the first night of study. And so what happens is He wants Jeremiah not to express His compassion. I'm careful here. In fact, I edited this chart this very morning because it hit me. I don't want to say that Jeremiah withdrew His compassion from His people. He didn't. And God didn't either in that sense. But from the standpoint of them receiving any good from God's hand, time for punishment had come. And Jeremiah wished to share, of course, God's convictions there. People would die even without burials. In the same chapter again, chapter 16, verses 8 and 9, Jeremiah was told not to attend any feast. Moreover, you shall not go into a house of feasting to sit with them to eat and drink. For thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I'm going to eliminate from this place before your eyes and in your time the voice of rejoicing and the voice of gladness, the voice of the groom and the voice of the bride. Now think about that. You know, you didn't really think of weddings as a time of great rejoicing. Robbie's getting ready for this time of rejoicing. That's what we think of when we think of a marriage. We think of a time of great rejoicing, and we think of feasting as a time of rejoicing, maybe some type of particular celebration of some event. But God told Jeremiah, I don't want you attending any of these kinds of feasts. Why? Because the time of joy is soon over. And this would be indicative of that. Then in chapter 18, the potter's clay. The potter's clay. When I start talking about this, some of you may automatically go to the broken vessel, the broken pottery. That's chapter 19. We'll get to that next. But in chapter 18, the story is that Jeremiah was to go down to the potter's house. When he got there, he observed the manufacturing of a piece of pottery, the clay in the hands of the potter, but the potter is trying to work with the clay, and the clay was what's called marred in his hand. The clay itself that he used was not adequate for the job that he was undertaking. The particular vessel that the potter was trying to make could not be made from the quality of the clay that he had that he was working with. And so he had to discard that. What does that signify? And I've added a couple of passages. Job used this same type of analogy, showing God's relationship or the relationship of the people to God. That is, that they are clay in the potter's hands. Paul in Romans 9, verses 20 and 21, used the same type of language, borrowing from the prophets. And so we understand the concept of that. Shall the thing formed, Paul said, say to him that formed it, why have you made me this way? People in religion, I need to take an aside here for a minute, they actually think of themselves as having the right as the clay to say to the potter, why have you made me this way? God, why did you make these rules? Why did you limit the local church in this way? Why did you make our worship spiritual? Why are things to be done decently and in order? I want to have a party when I attend church services. And people start questioning the sovereignty of God when the clay questions the potter who has the right from a lump of clay to make whatever vessel he wishes. That's Paul's application. Well, now here, what this signifies is simply the moral and the spiritual corruption, the degradation of Israel. That's what it's describing. I know that from the following verses there, particularly verses 15 through 17 of this chapter. He's describing their departure from God. Now then, they had corrupted themselves, and the potter couldn't make with them what he wanted to make. They would now have to die. They would have to be punished with sword, famine, and plague. That was going to be their end. Then in chapter 19, though, we have the clay jar. The clay jar is significant. Jeremiah was told to purchase a clay jar. Now, he was told to buy the girdle, and he was told to buy the clay jar. Jeremiah evidently had some purchasing power, but he was told now to go buy the clay jar, and he was told to take it with some of the elders and the priests of the people there and go off down to the edge of the valley of Hinnom. And when you get down there, take the clay jar and burst it. Throw it on the ground. Break it. And what this was to signify is that God was judging Judah for their sins. Certain sins are enumerated, particularly here, the sacrifice to idols and child sacrifice, particularly. So he told, that's what it represented. When he broke the jar, with the people watching here, this would, of course, would be a vivid way of making this point that God was breaking Judah. God was breaking Jerusalem. He was smashing. In fact, that's one of the words that I ran across in one of the word studies from the standpoint of the meaning of this word to break. The idea of smashing, to smash this jar. And it was the smashing of judgment in judgment of Judah. And also, there's something else to this that I need to comment on, but carefully. The idea of it is also something that cannot be put back. So it was irreparable. Now you say, but wait a minute, doesn't chapters 30 through 33 talk about restoration? Yes. And aren't there messianic portions of the book of Jeremiah? Absolutely. And we'll talk about those tonight, the Lord willing. But the point here is that for a great many people, this was the end. They were going to die. If you read of the sieging of the city of Jerusalem and what happened there to the people inside, it happened just as Moses had proclaimed, just as he had declared in Deuteronomy 28. It was bad. The people were so hungry, they were doing things that were just that would defy our sensitivities to do. Let me just mention a couple. When you have a mother who would actually eat her own child, isn't that inconceivable? Isn't that just almost unbelievable? When you have a woman who would eat her own afterbirth, I'm not trying to disturb anyone. I'm trying to emphasize how bad this got. And that's what they said would happen. That's what Moses said would happen. That's hunger. And the plagues that set in there because of the diseases that set in, because of deaths, because of the and plagues, and just perpetuated itself. And then the deaths as a result of swords that were used in judgment upon the people. And so God would do this, and when the clay jar is broken, and I use the word irreparable because for some this would be utterly the end. When you think of 70 years of captivity, now apparently Jeremiah lived a long time. Jeremiah lived to be very old, remarkably, given the content of the book of Jeremiah. It was only by God's direct assistance that he managed to survive that deal. But when you think about many of them, they're going to die somewhere along this period of time in 70 years of captivity, those that weren't killed, you see, and were carried off captive. That's going to mean that a lot of them are going to die in captivity, will not come back to see the land. In chapter 24, there's another one of these figures of speech, the figs. Some more symbolism here. Jeremiah was shown two baskets of figs out in the front of the temple, which is significant. This is a very important place. One basket of figs was very good. Another basket was very bad. The good figs, God said, represented the exiles whom He would watch over. God would watch over them. Some would be able to return. Their children would be able to return. Others were bad figs, like Zedekiah, for example, who's mentioned here. Like Zedekiah, bad figs that are simply meant for destruction. They will have to die. They are the objects of God's wrath. One of the most interesting stories, the symbols in the book, is the yoke. It's described in chapter 27 early in the reign of Zedekiah. Now, according to chapter 28 in verse 1, a little bit of an inspired commentary here, this was actually the fourth year of Zedekiah, which we know to be 593 B.C. This is when this happened. 593 B.C. Jeremiah is told to make a yoke of straps and crossbars. I ran into a little bit of a textual difficulty here, depending upon the translation you use. Depending thus upon manuscript, sometimes that's plural. He was told to make yokes, but sometimes some Bibles have it singular. Now, there's two possible explanations. Has no real impact on the meaning of the symbol here. Some believe that he was to make, as it seems to suggest in some translations, that Jeremiah was supposed to make a yoke for himself and also for the necks of all of those envoys that were sent from these various kingdoms, and I think I have them, yes, enumerated, Edom, Moab, Ammon, Tyre, and Sidon. Zedekiah had already heard the message, as I point out. So some believe that it's plural yokes there, and one for Jeremiah and one for all of these, each of all of these envoys. But another way of looking at that is that plural could also be explained in that in making a yoke you have to have two beams, two wooden parts that are fastened together, that Jeremiah was the only one wearing the yoke. And thus any significance otherwise was that these envoys were to go and tell the story to their respective kings. Hey, this is what that prophet in Jerusalem did. He took a yoke and put it on his own neck and said, "This is how you all are going to be yoked in Babylonian bondage." Either way, there is still some great significance to this. Jeremiah, we do know, put the yoke on his own neck because of what we studied last night. Hananiah, that false prophet, that literally took the yoke off of Jeremiah's neck and broke it to signify that Jeremiah was wrong. We talked about that last night. I'll skip through parts of that if I get to it here this morning. But the idea is that the countries, these nations, were all coming under the yoke of Babylonian control. When you study the book of Jeremiah, there's so much emphasis on Judah and Jerusalem that you tend to forget that the Babylonians were sweeping through the whole land. They were a world empire. And so you need really to look at chapters 46 through 49. And then when you get to chapters 50 and 51, in case we don't get to talk about this later, when you get to chapters 50 and 51 of Jeremiah, that's God's indictment of Babylon. Babylon now is going to come under the control of another kingdom. And certainly that happened with the kings of Media and then the alliance that they had with Persia. But anyway, this is the yoke. And Jeremiah had it on his neck. The false prophets were going around saying, "You will not serve the king of Babylon," verse 14. Well, when the king of Babylon marched in upon them and started to invade the city, they had to change their story. But Hananiah said, "Oh, it won't be very long. All the articles will be brought back from the Lord's house, back from Babylon. Those, that is, that were carried off in 605 and 597. See, the two earlier deportations. And so this is the argument the false prophet is making. Hananiah, we talked about last night. He said he took that yoke off of Jeremiah, and he said that God's going to break the yoke of the king of Babylon within 2 years. By the way, in chapter 30 and verse 8, I did not mention last night. Chapter 30 and verse 8, God said He's in control of any yoke breaking. If there's going to be any yoke breaking going on, it won't be done by the people. The yoke will be broken by God, or it will be preserved by God. Jeremiah said this yoke was going to last 70 years. Hananiah said it's going to last 2 years. But anyway, the yoke represented the yoke of bondage. When Hananiah broke that yoke, as we talked about last night, that wooden one, God said, "Well, I have a backup yoke. You may have broken a wooden yoke, but I'm going to make a yoke of iron." A yoke of iron. And as Jeremiah prophesied, Hananiah died just 2 months after this. This was the will of God. There's another fascinating symbol in the book, chapter 32. This is recorded in chapter 32 where Jeremiah was told to purchase a field, a plot of ground. Why was he told to buy this? Well, his cousin, as he was told, would come to him. His cousin came to him, a fellow named Hanamel. And he offered to sell this piece of property to Jeremiah. And Jeremiah went through the procedure for land purchase, which is not unlike what we would do today in our country. He weighed out the 17 shekels, that is, he made the monetary payment. There were witnesses involved in this that watched as the deed is signed and sealed. If you ever purchased a house or property, you know what you're talking about there. Or an automobile with a title. And so, not unlike what we're used to today, this is a normal process, all this taking place right there in the city of Jerusalem. And the deal was made. Why? Oh, I forgot one point here. Baruch was given the deed, and he was told to put this in a clay jar so that it would be preserved. So that it would be preserved. That's significant. Why did this happen? Why did this happen? Jeremiah would never live on his property. In fact, when we see him later going out to go look at his property, this happened, by the way, this opportunity arose because the Babylonians were distracted after their invasion of Jerusalem. They were distracted and had to go whip down the Egyptians for a little while who were rising up. And he went and took care of them and they came back. By the way, that was a basis for some of the false prophets saying, "Ah, look, Babylon's leaving. It's like Ananias said." Be careful. Be careful how we interpret things that we may see. We must use good judgment there. Judge righteous judgment, Jesus said, John 7:24. But anyway, he was told to buy the land. He wouldn't live on it, but the purchase was significant. Look at chapter 32 and verse 16, repeated again in verse 44. "For this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says, houses, fields, and vineyards will again be bought in this land." This, by the way, you notice where this is, Jeremiah 32. I mentioned that chapters 30 through 33 were restoration chapters. This is significant. The people will return. Jewish people will return. Not all of them did. But we do begin to see under Zerubbabel first and under Ezra and Nehemiah, the respective returns from captivity. Some lived, stayed in the land of Babylonia. Some went other places, but many returned back to Judah. And God said, "The reason, Jeremiah, I've told you to buy this field is because it signifies that people will once again occupy this land, that the Jewish people will." This gives them hope. I was just talking with Bob earlier. It seems that a lot of people take the interpretive approach of Jeremiah and Isaiah, by the way, and any of the return passages and remnant passages and all aspects of those and try to make those exclusively messianic. And I see a great danger in that. It's like people who take the book of Revelation and they say, oh, this is all in our future. The binding of Satan, that's all has to do with tribulationism and premillennialism and all those other fabricated isms. And they'll take all of it and try to make every bit of it in our future. I have a question. How on earth would that help the people, the saints of John's day? How would that interpretation help them? That would do nothing for them. I obviously understand that there's the hope of life after death, but that's taught throughout the New Testament. No, there was some significance in the book of Revelation for the people to whom John wrote. The seven churches of Asia, but seven being that whole number that represented all of the churches of the saints. Anyway, that's another study. But here we have the same thought. And I would suggest to you, as we will deal with a little more tonight, to think in terms of a physical return. And by the way, doesn't history prove the point? That's what they did. They returned, they rebuilt the temple, and they rebuilt the city and the Jerusalem walls. So seems like the proof is in the pudding. But this is the significance of the purchase of the field. And, well, I think I'm going to be able to finish the lesson this morning. I feared that I wouldn't. In Jeremiah chapter 43, something very interesting as well. Jeremiah was told in Jeremiah chapter 43. Now, let me give you just a little bit of background here. He's in Egypt. He's in Egypt with the people who had decided to go against the will of God. The expressed statements of Jeremiah that cautioned them, do not go there. The Babylonians left a man named Gedaliah in control of the province. And everything was going to be fine. The poor people, remember, of the Jews, were going to be left there in the land. By the way, the poor who didn't have that haughty, arrogant attitude we're going to talk about in the next lesson this morning. The poor that were more inclined to listen to God, they didn't put their faith in the blind leaders that were leading the others. They didn't have their faith. And so there's some people left there. Jeremiah was going to be one of those people left there. But this band of rebels said, no, we're leaving. We're going to throw off the yoke of Babylonian bondage, and we're headed to Egypt. And that's what you see in chapters 44 and 45, 43 and 44 of Jeremiah. Well, Jeremiah is taken captive by these guys. He didn't go of his own will. He's forced to go to Egypt. That's where he is here. Well, God comes to him in Egypt and gives him the message. Jeremiah, I want you to take some big stones, and I want you to place them. I think of pavers when you think of the old style of roads that were made. Stone pavers. Go into this clay road that contains these bricks and place these large stones in this brick pavement that goes to the house of Pharaoh's palace in Daphne. Remember what I said the other night? I like the Greek word because this word here would be hard to pronounce, Tapanis, but actually the Egyptian has the hard K sounds in it, so it's Tapanis. Tapanis is probably the way that should be pronounced. But anyway, that's where the palace was. Place them in the stone brick pavement that leads down to the palace at Tapanis. That's verses 8 and 9 of Jeremiah chapter 43. Now, what did that indicate? You know what happened? The significance of this was that God would destroy the Egyptians. But the main thing was he went down there, he sent the Babylonians, his slayer, you remember, the sword that was actually in God's hand, the people of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, my servant. Nebuchadnezzar took the army down there, and Nebuchadnezzar, and they killed these people in Egypt, these Jews that had rebelled against the teaching of Jeremiah. And Nebuchadnezzar actually set up his royal tent over the stones that Jeremiah had set in that pavement. Fascinating. God told him, here's what I want you to do. Here's the significance of it. Nebuchadnezzar's royal tent will be situated right there on that spot. And that's what happened. And the significance of that is great. Because those people thought, surely we can go down here to the land of Egypt and escape. Always turn to Egypt. The staff that would just put a splinter in your hand when you leaned upon it. And certainly that's what happened here. They go down to Egypt. And they try to escape the Babylonian control. God sends the Babylonians down there, and they're just as tortured and tormented there. They didn't escape. They thought they were very smart to try to pull that off. But no, it didn't work. And so again, we see some judgment language here, and quite a bit of it. but stated a little differently in more of an interesting way. And I think in a way that helps us somewhat to be able to possibly gain a little from it. Because, you think of the broken clay jar. You think of not marrying. You think of buying a field knowing that you're not going to live on it, but that others will be able to occupy the lands. And quite instructive there. Well, I guess I'll quit for now. In the AM worship study, we're going to be talking about why all of this happened from the standpoint of the sins that Judah had committed. Appreciate your attention this morning.